It is my great pleasure to share with you some background information about our speaker for today, our very own Keith Forrester. Keith, a Sacramento native, came to St. Anthony's Seminary in Santa Barbara at the age of 13 in 1948 to study for the priesthood. His formation for the priesthood took 13 years. During his college years, he lost his sight, but with special permission, he was allowed to continue his studies. After studying theology, Keith was ordained a Franciscan priest at Old Mission Santa Barbara in 1961. He was immediately assigned to St. Mary's Parish in Stockton, California, where he served as an assistant pastor for the next 3 years. In Stockton, he was involved in an inner city parish with many outreach ministries. And it's my understanding that that's where he met Nancy. Next, he was assigned to teach fundamental dogma at Old Mission Santa Barbara's School of Theology. He taught theology for 2 years in Santa Barbara. Then the school was moved to the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And after teaching in Berkeley for 2 years, Keith resigned from the priesthood in order to marry his wife, Nancy. In 1971, Keith and Nancy then moved to San Diego, where Keith earned his master's degree in rehabilitation counseling from San Diego University. After completing the master's degree, Keith was employed as a rehabilitation counselor with the California Department of Rehabilitation in Bakersfield. There he served for the next 10 years, primarily as a counselor for the visually impaired in Kings, Kern, and Tulare counties. In 1984, Keith and Nancy moved to Santa Barbara. They are members of St. Anthony's Worship Community and serve on the Liturgy Committee and have helped to design the liturgies for a number of years. And Keith is my supplier of spiritual challenge. He and Nancy go to these conferences with Richard Rohr every year, and they go to Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crosson, and Keith comes home with reams of books and tapes, and he's very willing to share them. So when I get up in the morning and do my exercises, I'm usually listening to Marcus Borg or Richard Rohr or someone like that. So I don't know, maybe you can entice him to that, lend you one or two of them too. Well, let us stand and ask God to bless Keith as he leads us in a thoughtful discussion of God, the heart of reality.
Let us use the blessing prayer on the board here.
May God bless you and you through you. May God's face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May God look upon you kindly and give you peace.
Amen.
Thank you.
Should I put
your hair on your shirt?
Sure, yes.
And here's Tom.
All right.
And here's the
pocket. All right. Oh, sure. Good. All right. Good. Can you hear me? Is it working? Good, good. Well, thank you for that nice blessing and introduction. As Barbara said, we've gone to hear Marcus Borg for several years, and he's one of my favorite authors. I find him very readable. I was telling somebody, the other day I was trying to read a translation of some of Karl Rahner's ideas on God. Wow, it was a mystery. About three paragraphs, I was totally lost. But Borg, I can follow. I just think he has such insights that they've done, opened up a lot of areas for me. And so I'd like you to think along with me, what's your idea of God? Does it really have much influence in your life? I think for many years, it didn't have a whole lot of influence in my life. You know, I grew up in a Catholic home. And even though, you know, it was a pluralistic society, we lived in the Catholic ghetto. You know, the school, the parish, all our friends. And so the faith, my idea of God, well, I just grew up with it. It was part of what we lived. But it was rather unexamined. And I think this continued on until even later, after I was teaching theology, one occasion, a whole class of newly ordained priests that were sent to Stockton for that pastoral year, sort of their internship, the whole class walked out and left. Ooh, what is going on? Well, you know, that was the 60s. You know, it was a rebellion against authority, and the institution was not moving, following out Vatican II the way they thought it should. All these beliefs, what did it matter? It's bunk. They all walked. So some years, not too long, maybe a year later, I did run into one of them, and I was asking him, you know, I realized that a lot of the requirements of the church and the way we express beliefs, that they're antiquated, they don't say a lot to you. But, you know, basically, isn't there an experience of God in your life that carries you through? And he made some remark like, God, what's that? Hey, yeah, yeah. You know, that everything had gone. And I really had to stop and re-examine, where am I with this whole idea of God? And thinking about it, I think my idea of God was like a catechism answer. You know, God's everywhere, cares for us, and on and on and on. And I put it all in a little box and taped it up and sat it on a shelf up in my mind. And it didn't influence my life very much. I was busy with all the secondary things. They were fun. You know, the new liturgy is developing and scriptures opening up. The scripture scholarship made so much more sense. The whole justice action thing, I was involved with the jail system and the farm worker movement. It was all very exciting. It took up all the time. I don't think the idea of God was very foremost in my mind until these questions started coming up. For all practical purposes, you know, Marcus Borg talks about supernatural theism. Oh, that's where I was. God was way up there and out there. For all practical purposes, I was a deist, you know, like our founding fathers. Yeah, God created things. He wound up this great machine we call creation, set it into motion, then he retired. You know, I think that was my thinking. God created, did all this creation work in 6 days, and the seventh day he rested. He's never woken up from his nap since. So I had to really start thinking, what does this mean in my life? Because that milieu in which I grew up, you know, the Christian home, my Christian ghetto of church and school and parish, it was disappearing. You know, the shocking thing in Europe then, the churches were already emptying out. What happened to the age of faith, this Christian culture? It was all disappearing. Disappearing because I think it never filtered down to most people as a commitment, a real experience. It was a cultural thing. This is what you grew up in. This is the way everybody was. This is the conventional society we lived in. And then when the questions came, there was nothing to hang on to. They were just myths in the way we took it in the bad sense, huh? Untruths. One thing that helped me, I don't even remember who began to talk about this, the stages of growth. And just to oversimplify it a bit, you know, when we're young, as a child, we're in that, sort of natural literalism. We take things on authority. Mom says, don't do it. Why? Because I told you so. That's why. Don't stick your hand in the fire. That's it. No, that's the way we have to learn. We take things literally. Like the little fella in Sunday school whose teacher is asking him, now, children, where do you think God is? Where's God? And so Johnny Ray said, God's in the bathroom. Just, now, don't be smart. He says, no. He says, well, what are you talking about? He says, every morning, my dad comes down the hall, and he bangs on the bathroom door and says, my God, are you still in there? So we take things literally. But some place in our life, and not necessarily locked into any time period, we come to a questioning. What does this mean? What are all these symbols and images and ritual? What does it mean? And I think we all know the whole variety of responses you'll get in your own life, in your family. Some people come to this point and decide, like these young fellows did, it doesn't have any meaning. I'm out of here. They walk. For some, it's indifference. Oh, well, what does it matter? For some, it's don't bother me with this stuff. I'm going back to the faith I learned as a child, and that's good enough for me. I don't go any further. For some, it's a time of maybe of suffering that brings this out. Being hurt by something the institutional church does, or some member of the clergy, or some other Christian, to where we really have to question, what does this mean in our lives if this is the way people act? And then you can go on to another stage. If you use the questions to grow, to start examining, and learn to, with prayer, experience what this can mean in our lives, then we come to another awareness. Maybe Ward would call it a metaphorical awareness, not a literal thing. But begin to see beyond the images and the beliefs and the laws in the institution to what they were meant to communicate to us. Maybe they're not doing that anymore. Maybe we have to look elsewhere. But a real experience and the commitment that somehow comes, I don't think it came in any great mystical experience for me. It came over many years of thinking and praying about it and saying, yes, this makes sense to me. I've got to go beyond just these human barriers, obstacles that come up. Let's look beyond it. Where do I look? Anita gave a great clue about hiding in the heart of man. And for me, I think the best summary is from a spiritual writer, Paula Darcy, that spoke at one of Richard Rohr's conferences, New Year's conference. And her phrase is, God comes to you disguised as your life. Ooh, that really sticks with me. And we have to learn to take a quiet time so we can listen and hear. You remember that song, The Sounds of Silence? Yeah, to me that's what it's saying. Take the time through prayer and meditation, and this is the way you're going to grow. Even reading, there's so many ways, but learn to recognize where God is in your life, what He's calling you to. So as I said, when you don't have that cultural Catholicism buoying you up anymore, what do you have? What do I have? What does this living out this Christian life mean? I think as supernatural theism is explained, it's pretty straightforward. You know, God out there intervenes at some times. That brings up a lot of problems. Why does He intervene for those guys and not for me? Jesus comes with all these great phrases. If you had faith, you could move mountains. And one author says, well, that's true, except that sometimes what you get from God is a shovel. Get busy, you do the moving. What are these images saying to us? And how we live. I grew up in that whole atmosphere of there are certain beliefs, you followed these beliefs, you followed these requirements, these rules. You gained merit, you stored up the indulgences, and you were saved. As Rohr calls it, you have purchased your spiritual fire insurance. Got enough merit there? Your butt's not going to burn in hell for all eternity. A very materialistic way, tit for tat, I do this, I get this, you get our reward, looking beyond this life. Now, gee, I think for my folks, this is where they were, and this was very meaningful for them. This is the way they live. I think what happens through the generation, pretty soon it's not meaningful anymore. And people are saying, that doesn't do anything for me. I need some deeper meaning. So I want to make this point that I think Borg makes it too. Because things have changed doesn't mean that other old stuff is bad, it's negative, it has those aspects, it just isn't saying anything anymore. So let's look beyond it. And he, of course, likes panentheism. Did you ever hear that term before?
No.
I did, but I ran across it, but not very often. Karen Armstrong, in her book, The History of God, picks that up. It says, she calls it the personification of God and the spiritual aspect of God. She says, not only is it through the religions of the book, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but many other religions, too. There's this wavering back and forth between, you know, how else can we talk about God except in our human terms, our human experiences? But the danger is, and God just becomes a super person, the highest being in our little realm of existence. And we lose sight of the awesome, the ineffable. That's what we cannot pin down. But, you know, what happens then, that's all very nice, but isn't that sort of vague and nebulous? And how do you pin it down? Like the story they tell about the entomology student who was trying to study this butterfly, and the butterfly wouldn't hold still. So he got a pin and pinned it down on a board so he could study it. And he killed it. I wonder if that's what we did, trying to give people certitude, you know, defining God, having all these beliefs and thinking, yeah, that's who God is. Well, it isn't. We can know God is, but not what God is. Think that every once in a while, this keeps coming up in Scripture, and in real theology, it keeps coming up, too. You can't define God. You can't think you've got him in a box. It's a lot safer that way. Get my box all wrapped up there on the shelf. Then I don't have to bother with it too much. But I think, for me, now, there's this constant call. Go beyond just the things I see and I experience. Look beyond them. In those, there's something that's talking to me. How about it? Maybe if we stop just for a minute and get some of your ideas. Where are you with God? You know, what are some of your images? Still God the judge? God the father? God the punisher? God the legislator? Where are you? Have you seen any development or really thought much about it? How about Barbara? Can you tell us anybody's?
Nobody's responding yet.
Okay. Just thinking about it.
Dorothy, I had a son long years ago who had birth defects. And I was telling a parishioner about it. And she says, oh, it's God's will. And I know right away, I said, God would not do this to a baby.
Mm-hmm.
It's an accident. And I surprised myself with that comment. Because I thought God is loving and kind and, you know.
Right.
And I know from there I really developed my image of God.
Wonderful. Yeah, that God is not the one who just zaps people. Yeah, that's great. Anybody else?
But prayer that goes to my mind is an old prayer of the church, but I just stop the first line, and it just comforts me all the time. I say, O God, our refuge and our strength.
Yes.
It keeps. I just say it like a little
right.
prayer.
Right.
It's my image of God right now.
Wonderful. Yes.
In one of Michael Morwood's books, he's talking about how everybody is trying to put God in a box and say what yeah. he is and what attributes he has. And he says, I've boiled it down to one thing. I think God is compassionate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. Yes, several ways.
Joanna?
I was really fortunate. I grew up in a peaceful home, and I grew up amid great natural beauty on Long Island. And there is where my basic notions of God came from. I have to say, a lot of those notions were curtailed by catechism.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to public school until high school, and then in high school, you know, the ratiocination of the faith, I think was very harmful.
Right.
I should have left it grow like Topsy.
how true that in trying to make things certain and clear, we killed it. Mm-hmm. Emptied the life out of it.
I'm with Dorothy. I think when we confront life's experiences, things that happen in our lives that we really have no control over, and we're confronted with these situations, and then it really makes you, this doesn't jive.
Yeah.
This doesn't jive with the way I've lived all my life. It doesn't jive with what people have told me. It doesn't work.
Right.
So then you start searching for, well, who is God? Who is God? Mm-hmm. What is that force?
Right.
I know it's there.
Right. That's about the most we know for sure, isn't it? Yeah.
Along those same lines, the thing that came up for me was unconditional love. You know, when you do bump up against those things that just really don't make sense, the judgment and the not measuring up for all the things that we even have in our head about the things we do ourselves. But, you know, I think the times when really that have been tough for me, I think that's when I come to it, knowing that I'm accepted and that I'm loved unconditionally.
Right. Great.
Jenny?
I think my experience was I was kind of a little Buddha baby. I was raised on the farm and was somewhat was slowed down in my development by a traumatic incident. And so I wandered around in apple grove and the farm along with my mother's apron strings and had in a rural area where we had no permanent priest. So never really had any of the much of the hell and damnation part. And my mother really lived the gospel. That was, we said the rosary around the table. All of us knelt, no matter how tired we were or anything. And so didn't have any, I feel like now I'm in my later years coming full circle. Mm. And had, when I got married and had my first child, I really experienced within myself of that child being divine and the sense of all with it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was attracted to Buddhism and studied Buddhism and went to many services with some of my daughters. And I felt familiar, and I realized all the things I had lived as a child, a silent child, mm-hmm. in nature. So it's exciting for me because now
yes.
I feel like I can embrace all humanity.
Yes.
And it's going back, but it's in a whole different understanding now rather than just being naive and just being a child.
Yes.
It's okay
yes.
as a child, but not as an adult.
Right.
Maureen, you had a comment?
Yeah, I think the part that I responded to really strongly in the fourth chapter on God was the sense or the experience of being addressed. I guess I hadn't heard that word before, and it meant so much more than God speaks to you. You know, we're so used to hearing that, but somehow the sense that we, that I am addressed by someone, this, this creator, and it's more of a person plus. The person buddy doesn't have all these things, you know, hands and feet, right, or whatever. But it's kind of like the experience of person plus something other that's there. But I guess it's that sense of being addressed and called in all the ways that happen, is what speaks to me.
Good.
Anita, Christine, I think I've mentioned many times, but my husband and I have practiced centering prayer for about 6 years, and it's interesting because we are witnessing in each one a change, and both of us have witnessed a total different perception of God, kind of unfolding on its own. And when I joined Word and Life, I was trying to find peers, you know. And what's most amazing is when you read these books, all of it seems very familiar to me, because I feel I have at some level experienced it, and often it has come to me out of the vacuum, the same truth that I've been told in these books. So because it seems familiar, it's extremely convincing to me.
Good.
There was some other hand. Gloria?
I can relate to Jenny a little bit, and I guess some of the other people as well, but my perception of God is through experience, and it's one of intimacy within, and some unexplainable, awesome, it's just beyond words. And I think that a lot of it came to me through grief. And I do think that's kind of sometimes what has to happen sometimes with people.
Right.
That was my experience too. I'm a scientist, and so for me, I kind of had a more analytical experience of God, originally thinking more like the great watchmaker, like the great set of emotion. And it took a grief experience in my life to bring me to that more kind of a personal relationship. Thinking of him.
Right.
I felt his presence alongside me going through that.
It really can transform us. That's one of Roar's favorite things. With suffering, you have to either learn to transform it or you'll transmit it.
My experience of God as a child was Catholic schools, of course, was the rules and the memorization and confession and the sacraments, and everything was outside of me, you know. God was in church, and God was when came to me when I went to church, but not so much, you know, other times. And now it seems in the years developing, it just seems that God is in my heart wherever I am. And if I don't get to church on Sunday, that's not a mortal sin for me anymore. So it's development, and it's encouragement, and readings, and and life's experience.
Any other comments?
I have had the same situation as you, keep growing up in mine was an Irish ghetto in Chicago. Everybody was Catholic, and we all went to the same schools. But I had this, on the way home from school one day, I was probably 8 years old, eighth grade, thinking about what my life was going to be like. And I thought, you know, this is pretty easy. I just want to have, I was an only child. I want to have 8 children. Send them all to Catholic school. This is great. This is how it works. Life will go on, and I'll just have them do what I'm doing, and it's going to work out fine. And then I married. And then I was divorced, and you're out.
Oh, yeah.
You're out of the club, and I had no support, no anything. I was then I had to start thinking, and I've been trying to think ever since, and Word in Life has helped me a great deal, and I think panentheism is talking to me, and I think Michael Moore, we talked about it, and Dearmuth talked about it, and then my grandchildren were born, and they weren't born with original sin.
Good.
So I'm thinking for myself.
Good.
Any other comments?
Liz, I have a different concept altogether. God is my buddy. He's with me all the time. All I do is say, hello, God, and I don't know. And it's been that way for years. And I don't know how to explain it, but we're talking to each other all the time.
Good.
I don't know. I just love it.
What you do know. Loving is knowing. Yeah, good.
Anne?
I just have one comment that seems to serve me well at this time in my life, and that is the scripture from, I think it's St. John's Gospel, or letters. And it's, God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him. And this serves well with relationships, and, you know, all the people you meet just
It sure shows a richness, isn't there, of our concept of God through our experiences and our development. There's so much, it's never going to end.
Carla has
it. Oh, Carla, sorry.
The supernatural idea of God as having a human body. I believe that God does have human body parts, not necessarily human, but that God has arms that can embrace us. And one time in particular, when I was going through a very difficult time, and my friend told me, just think of God as embracing you. And at night when I would go to bed and start to worry, that helped so much, that feeling of these huge arms embracing me. So I think God does have arms.
Wonderful image. Yeah, that, like, you know, even our vice presidential candidate, then remember she talked about global warming. Says it's God just drawing us closer. Oh, Sarah, I don't think so. But how we interpret. But that's good, brother. That's a great image. Speaking of images, if you were ever up in Mission San Miguel. Not one of the most glamorous missions, pretty plain. But over the altar, there's a triangle with a great big eye. When we were in the mission, our big plot was. And we hadn't even heard of taggers yet then. This great big eye there. And then talking to some of the parishioners who've been there for years, having a little discussion about that eye. Of course, some of them thought, oh boy, that's God judging me, you know. Maybe I can. Hid, maybe couldn't see me. Like when I was at the women's jail in San Joaquin County, these two women were in for something or other, and they were telling me their experiences growing up in New Mexico. And their grandmother caught these two little girls taking the Milagros off the statue, the little metal arms and legs and eyes of Thanksgiving for cures and things. A lot of them were silver, so they were. Take them off and then sell them for candy. And Grandma caught them. God is going to punish you because the saints could see who did that. They know who's doing that. Scared the living daylights out of them. Gillette came along. And then all the statues were covered with purple cloths. So he could steal the Milagros and the saints couldn't see who did it. And another prisoner talked about that eye. She said, oh no, that's God smiling at me. Everything I do, he's smiling. Oh, wow, okay. Different images. I like Borg's approach. I'd just like to say a little bit about, the panentheism, you know, the God that's out there. No, he's not out there. He's all around us, encompassing us. Ronner uses the image of we're an island in this great sea called God. No matter how deep we dive or how far we go, he's there. He's around us. God is a spirit that enhances and sustains and enables life to continue. So he is much more than we can ever grasp, and yet he's right here. Not out there, right here. And I have to learn to recognize it. Well, how can you be more than we can encompass and be right here too. It's, isn't that a contradiction? Well, this is where they use that term paradox, where things seem opposite, and yet the two of them are combined, make a reality, reality we call God. And part of our spiritual life is learning to hold the paradox in tension. We need that tension. We've got to hold it. In fact, this is our great image. The cross is a sign of the paradox. Heaven and earth, Jesus pulled this way and that way, his arms outstretched to embrace all through death. Ugh. How do you think all that stuff out? There's the paradox. I think, as you've all noticed, as you grow in spiritual life, things aren't so clear and defined. Sort of nebulous. You have to keep reaching out for it, keep growing for it. And a lot of these newer theologians, this is a little sidebar, but to me opened up a lot of, oh, that's what's going on. You know, Borg talks about the experience of the numinous, the more, and how panentheism is grounded in experience. Okay, human experience. Yeah, that's one great way to approach it. But now others are saying, oh, no, that's not where you start. You start with revelation and with the dogma of the church. That's where you begin. And then you can interpret human experience through that. And this isn't just a Catholic thing. Probably most of you have heard of Houston Smith, famous professor of world religions up in Berkeley. He's retired now, but he and Marcos are good friends with very different viewpoints. When Marcos wrote The Heart of Christianity, Houston Smith wrote The Soul of Christianity. And say, Marcus, you're a dear friend, but you're starting at the wrong place. You know, you start with what God has told us of himself with revelation. Marcus said, well, yeah, that's important, but that's not where I'm starting. Because now I think the human experience has great significance. And if you look at where new theology is coming from, it is from these human experiences. Some good, some bad. The terrible experience of the Second World War and the disillusion that these were Christian countries that are exterminating Jews and killing each other. Where was Christianity? Where was the church when all this is going on? It wasn't saying anything. Maybe it has nothing to say. Mm-hmm. Beyond the whole existential movement, life has no meaning. Ugh. It's just a bad stomach ache. It's a vision. Well, it looked pretty dismal at times. What can grow out of that? That sense of suffering, of disillusion, is maybe calling us beyond what we thought was so certain that we had a good hold of. Another great movement now is a whole feminist theology movement. Because when you look back, even Scripture and most of our Christian century, it's all patriarchal. Sure, in the Old Testament, there are images of God as the lover and mother and Sophia, but it's mainly patriarchal because that was the culture. Well, our culture now is saying, hey, that's not the only viewpoint. And with that, we're missing it. We're missing the compassion, the insight, the intuitive. We've got to go beyond just what, remember Anne talked about this in Scripture, the factual knowledge. Did it really happen? Did Jesus really walk on the water? Did he multiply those loaves? Well, if he did, how did he do that? You know, did a new one appear in the basket every time? Or just go zap, and there was a whole pile of them there? I'm missing the whole point. What's the meaning of all this? The factual knowledge, that's really important. And this is knowledge that, you know, we can experiment with. We can repeat the situation and find out what is going on. We can pin it down. We can define it. That's really important for science. You know, when I go to the doctor, I don't want him to tell me, you know, I was meditating on your case last night, and I think for your arthritic knee, you drink a glass of warm vinegar with honey in it. That'll do it. That's an old German or Dutch remedy. No, doc, I want you to give me something that you've experimented and tried out, and you know it works. But there is that other whole realm of knowledge, the intuitive, the insightful, the spiritual. And it got put down because you can't prove things with that. You can't, there's no mathematical formula that spells that out. Yet, who knows what they're going to come up with. One author said, probably some of the greatest theologians today are theoretical physicists. You know, they're going, keep going beyond and beyond, or saying, you know, maybe we're never going to know everything. But anyway, to get back to the whole feminist movement, the movement of the third world liberation theology, the experience of people saying, hey, the church is with the government. They were the people that always oppressed us. That's not how we have experienced God. God is the one who's giving that constant preferential option for the poor. And all these base communities that are growing up from that. And Romans saying, no. Listen to our teaching. You don't start with the human experience. And, you know, this is where I think one of the condemnations of people like Sobrino and Gutierrez. Rome is going that other direction. Remember the traditional paradigm and the new paradigm? No, they're opting for the traditional paradigm. This is where we talk about God, not all these experiences. And not only liberation theology, but all the ethnic theology, the black theology now that's developing more and more. And their whole experience of exile and enslavement. The theology of fiesta. I hadn't run across that one before. sometimes our liturgies seem very cold and staid to more exuberant people. A friend who was just visiting us was telling us about a Ghanaian young woman student who was staying with a friend and said how disappointed she was going to Mass here. She said, it's not a celebration. It's cold and people don't visit. There's no community. They all just leave right away. They don't even dress up for Sunday anymore. So at home, our Mass is at least 3 hours long. And they're singing, and there's dancing, and they're sharing. I think we've started missing something. Like a lot of our Northern European type of spirituality. Rather intellectual and cold. And have you ever gone to a Pentecostal service or charismatic service? Oh, I was uncomfortable at the beginning. You know, don't you think we'll ever be quiet in church? All this yelling and jumping around. A great enthusiasm there. The encounter of Christianity with other faiths, the pluralism now in the world. Open up. You know, maybe it's not, we're not the only one. So that story they tell about the fellow who St. Peter's conducting through heaven to find the right place for him, and they're going down the golden road, and over here these people are preaching and yelling, and he says, who's that? He says, those are the Baptists. They're strong on the word. And over here, the boy, there's this wonderful singing and instruments going. What's that? So that's a black church. Don't they have the rhythm and so on? And so each one they're going by finally comes past this great big compound. And it's really quiet. So he says, St. Peter, what's that one over there? He says, oh, you know, that's where the Catholics are. They think they're the only ones up here. But we found out we're not the only ones. And that all these beliefs and requirements that have put up walls. You know, if you're divorced and remarried, you're out. We slammed the door. And all we were talking about, how people have experienced God as compassion, as love, as embracing us. That's not God. That's our human tendency to set up barriers. Who's in and who's out? Who's elected, who isn't? So that's a great influence. I think probably the influence we've experienced here too is the new creation story. The whole evolutionary view of life now. And it's not just a set thing, it's continuing. And we're developing Teilhard's whole insight. And also the stewardship of the ecological movement. And what's that teaching us? So many of these modern movements are really enriching, I think, our theology. But it makes it messy. You don't have all the nice titles of the Summa, so you can go right to it. There are all these things impinging on us, but to me, this is just great. This is part of that wonder of God that we're never going to exhaust. Constantly, the reality is impinging on us and saying, listen, listen for me, wherever you are, wherever I am. I don't know if we want to say much about analogy and images. We've sort of talked about it already, but how do we talk about God? And we have to talk about God in images, because what else do we have? Even like Martin Buber said one time, we shouldn't even use the word God. It's so covered in blood. We shouldn't even use, fine, Martin, but what are we going to use? It's like, getting the right gender wording in the liturgy. How are we going to say, Father, Mother, God, he, she, God? We don't have the language yet to work out. So we use images. But always the care has to be taken. The image doesn't become the idol. And we forget that all images and signs and Jesus' parables, all pointing beyond themselves. The Buddhist thing that, religion and faith are just fingers pointing to the moon. They're not the moon. They're just pointing the way. And how can we point the way? What way is being pointed out to us? There's another point in there. Oh, and there are certain rules we're talking about God. First, we have to always remember God is ineffable. We're never going to capture him in our thoughts, in our definition. Secondly, there's always this seeking, this longing, this questioning. Rollheiser calls it the holy longing, the seeking. And then thirdly, our knowledge of God is always transmitted through us, mediated through culture, through signs. And we better make sure the signs are telling us something. Years ago, I had Congress classes, RCIA classes. This one man got very agitated because the lady had asked me to explain the missal to her. So we're explaining the missal and what's this, and he's getting more and more upset. I said, is there something when you say? He said, what's this missal stuff? And I said, well, this is the book we use. Oh, it's a book! Only missal. He knew about her intercontinental. The sign was not signifying for him. So we have to be careful. The sign keeps its meaning, points beyond itself. That the metaphor doesn't become emptied out. I think, when the idol loses its life, when the meaning and its power to engage you has gone, then it becomes an idol, a human thing that doesn't communicate with us anymore. So we have to be careful about that. There are so many beautiful things, like, just to mention, so do you ever think much about the Sunday parables? A lot of times they don't make a whole lot of sense, do they? They don't give us a clear answer. We've talked about it last week. What does that mean? And I think we have forgotten how images are used in this whole idea of communicating not just an answer, but calling for a response. To me, most of the parables are like John Dominic Rossi calls them. They're like koans, like the Buddhist sayings, like one hand clapping. What's that mean to you? The third bank of the river. And we start thinking about that, folks. What's it mean? Some of the riddles in Hinduism and stories in all the world religions that are calling you to change your way of thinking. Forbes transformation. That's how we're going to find the relationship. Jesus uses all those strange paradoxes. He who loses his life for my sake will find it. He who seeks his life will lose it. You know, come follow me. Take up your cross. He who's the first will be last, the last will be first. So if I really want to be first, I can act real humble. And then that puts me up to the front. No. Come on, you're missing the whole point.
We have about 5 minutes.
Okay. Let's just wind it up there. So there's so much more we can go through with the analogy stuff, and maybe we can talk about that later on. But again, just to come back to that one question of what does it matter? God, what's God? Does it matter in my life? And to me, the matter is, like Darcy says, the God coming into my life as disguised as my life. And how do I find it? For me, it's through prayer. They keep talking about contemplation. Does that sound sort of ominous? Like, oh, that's for people in the monastery. They're wearing those long robes. How am I supposed to do that? Yeah. Lots of people are writing on how you do that. Becoming mindful. Really examining what we've taken for granted for so long. So, let's just pause there. Let's take our break, and then we can come back for some more commentary or whatever.